From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kass. We're On the Record. Following mass shootings in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and Newtown, Connecticut, some have called for making it easier to force people into mental health treatment. But can involuntary treatment do more harm than good? Psychiatrists Dr. Dinah Miller and Dr. Annette Hansen have written Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. Dr. Miller says there's a double standard about mental health treatment that makes it difficult for people to get care before their mental illness escalates.
An insurance company will only pay for it if there's a fear that this person will be a danger to themselves or others. And we would tolerate that in this country for no other illness.
We discuss when committing someone makes sense and what alternatives should be explored. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. When does it make sense to force psychiatric treatment on someone who doesn't want it? Or does involuntary treatment ever make sense? Some argue that when a patient is so mentally disorganized they don't know they're ill, forced treatment is a way to get them help and may prevent suicide, violence, or incarceration. On the other side is the argument that involuntary treatment deprives a patient of her basic human rights, her autonomy, and may traumatize her so deeply she'll avoid treatment when she needs it in the future. My guests today are two psychiatrists who encounter these arguments often and who have treated patients affected by involuntary treatment. They wanted to probe the arguments more deeply and give voice to those on each side, so they collaborated on a book titled Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. Dr. Dinah Miller is an instructor in psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
And Dr. Annette Hansen is assistant professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins and the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
For listeners who have not encountered involuntary treatment, and one of your points is that we don't really know how widespread it is, although we do know that the rules are different in each state, give us a working definition of what involuntary treatment is.
Involuntary treatment essentially is care that's given against the wishes of the patient. This is not someone who agrees that they need help or wants help. It's a situation that creates an adversarial response from the patient, between the patient and the patient's family. It's not something we would do as a first choice.
There's also then an adversarial response between the patient and the treatment team. And the funny thing about it is sometimes people don't know if they've been involuntarily treated. In interviewing people for the book, I spoke to many people where when I got down to, well, was there a hearing with a judge? The answer they gave was no. And it came out that they actually didn't know. They didn't want to be in the hospital. But if you go to the emergency room and they say, oh my, your blood sugar is sky high and you need to come in, and you're thinking, well, no, I have dinner plans tonight. I don't want to be in the hospital. You may just be signed in and you go in and you don't say, I'm not going in. So some people were told you need to be in the hospital. They didn't want to be in the hospital, but they went in voluntarily, because we define it as voluntarily unless you say, I'm not going in.
Dr. Miller, are you saying that it's more common that someone actually was in the hospital involuntarily, but they didn't think it was, but they thought they'd chosen? Or is it the reverse, that even though it was handled in a way that the medical system considers a voluntary hospitalization, they felt that they were pushed into it?
It was some of both. So one thing that can happen is that someone can be told, look, if you don't sign in, we're going to force you to come in. And so the person signs in. So to them, they're not a voluntary patient, but legally, they're a voluntary patient. It's more coerced or cajoled. In talking to people, I generally sought out people who had a hearing.
And when you talk about a hearing, this is a hearing before a judge in a court?
That depends on the state. So in certain states, civil commitment hearings are held in an actual courtroom in front of a criminal law judge wearing the robe and the whole shebang. In Maryland, our commitment hearings are held by administrative law judges, and they're held within the hospital on the inpatient unit.
But we're not talking about a conversation in the doctor's office where...
No, we're not.
We're talking about something that involves the legal system.
That's correct.
What is a typical case of involuntary treatment? Is there such a thing as a typical case of involuntary treatment?
So there are really two situations in which people are involuntarily treated. And the most common one is somebody has had a suicide attempt. They come to the emergency room because they've tried to kill themselves. They haven't succeeded, obviously. And there's a concern that they might still kill themselves. And they're depressed. You have to be both dangerous and mentally ill. So somebody in that circumstance may be put in a hospital against their will. And that's a typical story. Another typical story is that somebody's suffering from psychosis. And by psychosis, we mean very clearly that either they're having delusions or they're having hallucinations. So they have a belief, often a paranoid belief, that somebody's trying to harm them, that there are cameras in their walls. And these stories usually have very complex plots to them. And they're not something that's just isolated, oh, my wallet was moved, but it's a whole disorganization in their behavior and a whole paranoid cycle or psychotic cycle. And there's a fear that they're dangerous. So that would be the second set of people who are involuntarily committed. So either people who are suicidal or people who are in danger because of their disorganization due to psychosis.
That's psychiatrist Dr. Dinah Miller here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with me here is Dr. Annette Hansen, a psychiatrist. They have together written a book called Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. I was surprised to read that some people consider involuntary outpatient treatment even more coercive than hospitalization, because I always thought involuntary treatment was a hospitalization.
Well, it depends on how the statute is written. Maryland is one of the few states in the country that doesn't have an outpatient commitment law, although there are proposed regulations now being considered for our state. Most outpatient commitment laws require a patient to have had a history of at least one or more civil commitments before they're considered for outpatient commitment. The majority of people who are on outpatient treatment, they want it because the process is being used as a way to leverage people into the healthcare system who might not otherwise be able to get a treatment slot. So it's a way of getting them bumped up on a waiting list for outpatient services. So even though technically it's involuntary, many of the people that we interviewed agreed to it and wanted it because it was a way of getting care that they wouldn't have otherwise been able to access.
So this sounds like another way in which what something looks like legally on paper doesn't actually describe what the situation is for the patient. Dr. Annette Hansen.
It's really being used as a mechanism to increase community services because it requires an inpouring of millions of dollars to build the services that these patients are supposed to be legally able to access.
Now, what I want to add to that is
Dr. Dinah Miller.
That New York is really the gold standard for this. And New York has pumped a fortune into this system. So if you're in New York, you may be in a situation where you've been involuntarily committed to the hospital, and upon release, a judge mandates you to outpatient services, which then mandates the system to provide treatment to you that you might not otherwise get. So many people say, okay, yes, I want this because I want to get out of the hospital already. Many states don't have any extra money for outpatient commitment. So if you're in one of those states, like, for example, the Virginia Tech shooter, he had been hospitalized overnight for, I think, concerns about stalking a girl. And the judge released him from the hospital the next day saying, you must go to treatment. There was no mechanism to follow him or to see if he actually went, and no services provided. And a couple of years later, he showed up at the school with semi-automatic weapons and killed many people. So you get into the, what does it mean for each state? And in some states, in Washington, you go before a panel, Washington, D.C., and the panel decides whether or not you should go to inpatient or outpatient services. So you can be mandated to outpatient care without being an inpatient first. And I think the bottom line of what I'm saying is this is all very confusing. And the discussion of civil commitment, what we call it, because it's people who have not yet committed crimes or never commit crimes, is probably 50 discussions because it's one for each state.
Repeatedly, you express frustration in the book that the U.S. puts so much effort into forced care but doesn't make mental health treatment available to so many people who want it.
Yes, isn't that funny?
And to follow up on a point that Dr. Miller made, in order for outpatient commitment to work, it has to be funded. People really need to know this in Maryland because New York is spending $32 million annually to support the services for outpatient commitment.
And before they even set this in place to get this to be acceptable to New Yorkers, they put $125 million into the infrastructure of their mental health system. This is a fortune. At one point, President Obama suggested putting $60 million into the mental health system for the entire country, and New York was doing $125 million.
So to be in a situation where we would turn less frequently to involuntary treatment, we need to pony up a lot more money.
Well, I think one of the things you want to say is, do we want to have such an emphasis on involuntary treatment, or do we want to have more accessible care for people earlier in the stages of their problems? So you're depressed, and you get horribly depressed, and you become suicidal, and you have a suicide attempt. What if when you started to get depressed, it was easy to get treatment? And even in places with lots of psychiatrists, and many parts of our country have no psychiatrists, it's hard to get into care. So we're talking about forcing people to get care when it's really hard to get voluntary care.
We need to take a quick break here. Lots more to talk about. This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. When we're back, I'd like to talk about some alternatives to involuntary treatment. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about when it makes sense, if ever, to force someone to undergo psychiatric treatment. The book we're discussing is Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. Its authors are both psychiatrists here with me in the studio, Dr. Dinah Miller of Johns Hopkins Medical School and Dr. Annette Hansen of Johns Hopkins and the University of Maryland Medical School. You shaped the preface of this book, recounting the mass shootings in Aurora, Colorado and Newtown, Connecticut, and write about how the reaction to a mass shooting is often a call to make involuntary commitment easier, to eliminate some of the procedures. And then it's 250 pages until you write more about the relation between mass shootings and involuntary treatment. Is prevention of mass violence a big or a small part of the picture of involuntary treatment?
It's a small part. I mean, involuntary care does not reduce violence. Fewer than 4% of violent crimes are due to people with serious mental illness. They're much more likely to be the victim of violent crime than a perpetrator of violent crime. What involuntary care can do, and we have a whole chapter on gun issues too, is it can prevent suicides, which is a much greater issue for our society.
The other thing is we don't know how many people would have been mass shooters who aren't because they got psychiatric care, some form of psychiatric care, either voluntary or involuntary, because you don't know what didn't happen. We do know mass shootings are increasing. But as we point out in the book, the worst year for mass shootings was 2012, when there were 7 in this country. There are 340 million people. Half of all people will have some type of psychiatric problem during their lifetime. And about 4.5 million people will have very serious psychiatric problems. And of those people, there were 7 mass shootings, and not all of those mass shootings were about mental illness. So you're talking about not looking for a needle in a haystack, but you're talking about looking for a piece of hay in a haystack if your goal is to prevent mass shootings. But one of the scary things about mass shootings is it's something that could happen to anybody. Anybody could be in the airport in Fort Lauderdale and have somebody shoot them, as happened last week.
And picking up on that, because anybody feels like, oh my gosh, I could have been there. And this was someone who had had a mental health evaluation just 2 months before the event. And so why couldn't they stop him? Why couldn't they have kept him in treatment? I think that's how a lot of people react to that.
Well, and I think what you're talking about is really the challenge in predicting violence, and especially incidents that are extremely rare. Mental health professionals certainly work with violent people, but they don't have a crystal ball. So you assess risk and you weigh the risk, but ultimately a risk assessment does not guarantee a good outcome.
That's forensic psychiatrist Dr. Annette Hansen here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here is psychiatrist Dr. Dinah Miller. Together, they have written a book called Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. You write about some alternatives to involuntary care or initiatives that you think could make it less common.
Right. Well, I think that's an important issue because when we talk about access to care, oftentimes the conversation gets limited just to inpatient beds. And we know that over time, the number of our inpatient beds have been dramatically decreasing, but that's not the only type of intervention that should be available. So we're also talking about access to care through other opportunities like outpatient clinics, day hospitals, peer support centers, walk-in clinics, mobile treatment teams, assertive community treatment, and crisis intervention trained police officers. So we're not solely talking about inpatient psychiatric beds.
Most of those I followed except assertive
community treatment. These are teams of mental health professionals who identify seriously mentally ill people and bring the treatment to them. So in involuntary care, the patient is brought to the treatment. With assertive community treatment and mobile treatment, the treatment goes to the patient wherever he or she might be. So clearly everybody we treat doesn't have a stable living situation. And wouldn't it be nice if we were able to provide this to them at the time and the place that they needed it?
Mental health courts. Give me a short version of how a mental health court works.
A mental health court is a type of specialty court. There are a number of different types of specialty courts like drug court, veterans court. With mental health court, you have people who are charged with crimes, who have certain types of serious mental illness, and instead of placing them through a usual criminal prosecution, they're placed in a court proceedings that's a non-adversarial process. And so it's more like a continuity of care setting. So the judge will follow one specific case over time. They'll have regularly scheduled status conferences, and everybody involved in that defendant or now the patient's care will show up at the hearing and report on the defendant's progress. So you'll have a social worker, a public defender, a state's attorney, and the judge will give sanctions or in some cases rewards depending on how the person does. Mental health courts actually do work, but they are to a certain extent voluntary because the defendant has to agree to it, but failure to agree to it could result in a jail sentence. So there is a certain amount of leverage that gets brought into play.
The patient in this setting or the defendant in this setting gets the choice. Would you like to go to mental health court? It's a voluntary thing. Or would you just like to be prosecuted for your crime? The unfortunate thing about it is if it's a very low sentence, something like a misdemeanor trespassing charge, nobody takes the mental health court option because the risk is that you're going to end up in jail for longer if you don't comply with the mental health court requirements. So you wouldn't, for a very minor charge which doesn't have jail time or doesn't have a serious sentence, many people would not go with the mental health court route. But I follow Judge Jack Lesser for some time in mental health court, and I went to the meetings before the court hearings, and what was striking to me was that it was like watching a hospital. It was like rounds in a hospital where there are all these people talking about what happened to this defendant. What do you think we should do? He had a positive drug test, or he didn't keep an appointment, or does he need, you know, and this is what his mother says he's doing, and this is what his psychiatrist says he was doing. And it was quite impressive.
We haven't really talked about the financial aspect of any of this. And I'm just curious as to How big a factor is, say, insurance in all this?
The kind of patients that we're talking about more often than not in mental health court don't have regular private insurance. These are state-funded services. Mental health courts themselves are usually funded by grants through the federal government.
But if you're talking about your average person in the emergency room, the sad thing in this country is that if you're not dangerous, an insurance company doesn't want you in the hospital. So the doctor may say, I think this patient needs to be in the hospital. Or the patient may come and say, you know, I'm severely depressed and I want to go into the hospital. An insurance company will only pay for it if there's a fear that this person will be a danger to themselves or others. And we would tolerate that in this country for no other illness. You can be admitted for diabetes or cardiac disease, even if we're not worried that you're going to die tomorrow.
So there's a double standard.
Absolutely.
You conclude that involuntary psychiatric treatment should be a last resort, Dr. Miller.
Yes. And I think what happens is, and everybody would say that. There's not really anyone who's saying, hey, this should be the first resort. But what's happened is we've got these advocates for mental health care who want it to be easy to get people into the hospital involuntarily. And we have civil rights advocates saying it should be harder to get people into the hospital. And so it somehow translates into this funny thing where somebody's in a crisis, they'll be in an emergency room, and somebody will say, well, are you having thoughts about hurting yourself or anyone else? And the answer is no. And so even if the person is very, very sick, the person in the emergency room, the doctor or the social worker, will throw up their hands and says, well, you're not dangerous and you don't want to come in, so I'm not even going to try that hard. Whereas they might spend some time talking to the person. Are you sure you don't want to come in? We have things that we can do to help alleviate your suffering. You know, you can sometimes convince people to do things they might not think they want to do, but which might make a difference in their lives. So I think we should put more emphasis on educating patients, on trying to meet them at their level. And there are patients, honestly, where they're not going to want to come into the hospital, and they're very sick and very dangerous, and there is no option but to put them in against their will.
This book is not a debate about involuntary psychiatric care. You're observers in this. So as observers, do you see any progress or improvement on the things that you just talked about? Are there states that are making it less onerous?
I can give you a really good example that I just saw at a conference last October. Of the city of Portland has an entire program where they train police officers on how to interact and interface with people with serious mental illness on the streets. It was brilliant. And they take certain selected officers and they hire professional actors to play the ill person, and they have actual scenarios that they do in their training where the other officers can watch and give them advice on what to do, tell them what questions to ask the person. And then they have a system where they take that information out into the streets and coordinate it with their community treatment services. And they have specified liaison people to hand off the case once they've met with the person on the street and to ensure follow-up. And this is the kind of thing that we think should be encouraged. It's called crisis intervention training. Unfortunately, there are very few of these programs, maybe 400 in the country, but we think this would be a great way to decrease the level of intensity and the risk of violence when these people come into contact with law enforcement for involuntary care. And with the right kind of interactions, they may be more likely to agree to voluntary care.
And the other thing I'll say is,
Dr. Miller,
we have gotten much better about this. The use of restraint and seclusion is remarkably less than it was years ago. And as we've closed state hospitals and let people out, many of whom have not had a way of getting other care, there were people in the state hospitals who didn't need to be in a hospital and have done fine in the community and have gotten community care. So it's a mixed bag, but yes, I think we're doing much better than we were, say, 50 years ago.
I really appreciate this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
And congratulations on the book. The book is Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care. Dr. Dinah Miller is an instructor in psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and Dr. Annette Hansen is assistant professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins and the University of Maryland School of Medicine. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you've been with us today. Join us tomorrow.